From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, we've all heard it before, eat less meat. People lucky enough to eat should eat less of everything.
When you look at the consumption of protein that human beings eat in the developed world, and for that matter in many transition economies, in other words, a large part of the world now, we eat significantly more protein than we need to repair our tissues for growing, for growth in children, and even for active adults who are using a lot of energy and a lot of muscle power and so on.
Microbe magic, having fun with microbes, growing them.
Oh, this one's much nicer, see? You see, really clearly see the purpley-orange patches of sulfur bacteria and the green patches of green sulfur bacteria.
I mean, these are things something that little kids could do.
Yeah. It's not toxic and not dangerous because these are environmental bacteria, so they're not going to harm you.
And Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Israel's eternal undivided capital for Jewish Israelis, not for indigenous Palestinians.
Israel demolishes 250 apartments a year, some that have multiple families, but Israel doesn't touch the building in which the settlers live. And we heard of multiple cases that Palestinians in the neighborhood are attacked.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before launching in, a request: help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. We have heard it before. To avoid impending Earth crisis, if it isn't too late, people need to change their eating habits. Those who have the choice should opt to eat food grown or raised close to home. Unpackaged, unprocessed foods contain less embodied carbon, and experts say, eat less meat. Takes lots of energy to grow meat. Livestock production generates lots of CO2 and methane and leaks nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus into the environment. Aside from all this, people who get to eat probably eat too much. So says Alan Buckwell, a British agricultural economist, turning to a concept associated with Swedish earth scientist Stefan Rockström. Buckwell co-authored a paper entitled "What is the Safe Operating Space for EU Livestock?" I spoke with Alan Buckwell about food consumption.
The proposition that we're over-consuming and we're over-consuming livestock is one that I now feel confident in saying I accept that. There's plenty of, I can point to the evidence that supports that statement. And there's no doubt there's massive damage arises from it. I mean, of course, the destruction of habitat isn't just for food production. It's for timber production, and it's for infrastructure and development. And of course, it's been going on since economic development's been going on. It's been going on for centuries. And in a sense, in the temperate parts of the world, we destroyed a large part of our forest quite a long time ago. We certainly did in Europe. And so we're now seeing other countries catching up, so to speak, but it's not doing the world any good. And the climate threat, in my view, the biggest threats are the greenhouse gases, the climate threat, the loss of biodiversity, and the oversupply of nutrients into the environment, particularly into water.
This is what you refer to as leakage.
Leakage, exactly. And this is the fundamental problem of livestock, is they're very leaky. When you feed essential nutrients, nitrogen and potassium, that's the basis of all protein and all life, that when you look at the kilograms, we now have assessments of the flows of those elements in Europe. I don't know whether you've done it for North America. That when you look at the tons of nitrogen and phosphorus applied to agricultural land, how much is taken up by crops? Of that, how much is eaten by animals? Of that, how much is retained by the animals to maintain their own bodily functions and their own bodily structures? And how much of the crops and the animals eaten by human beings is used for their own bodily functions? And then how much isn't? And the answer is, it's sort of 70 or 80% of the nutrients that get into the system that leak back into the environment in one form or another. And when they do, they mostly do it in a way which cumulatively causes damage. The nitrogen gets out there in the form of nitrogen oxide and particulates, and it causes either greenhouse gas problems or ammonia, and it either causes greenhouse gas problems or human respiratory problems, but either way it's not very helpful. And the phosphorus is and the nitrogen are leading to eutrophication of rivers, lakes and oceans. And the problem is that when we do this year in, year out, decade in, decade out, for a steadily growing population, then we get out of balance. And that's what we're saying. We are out of balance.
And it's astonishing that human beings, humanity has deposited more, has more than doubled the amount of reactive nitrogen and phosphorus on the landscape since pre-industrial. It's a vast, vast amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that humans have put into the system.
Yep. Yes, exactly. And as I say, that it's harmful because it's reactive nitrogen, not the sort of unreactive nitrogen gas that makes up most of the atmosphere. And it turns out it's damaging. And so we have to limit it. And the other thing that, but you know, I do want to come to the other side, because we're focusing on the negative aspects of agriculture, and particularly livestock agriculture. And livestock are leaky because they're rather inefficient users of these things. Chickens are better than pigs, and pigs are better than cattle, and cattle are the worst of all in terms of pollution and leakage. But there's a positive story to tell. But let me just say one other factor that I found it was a heavy realization when it dawned on me, was that when you look at the consumption of protein that human beings eat in the developed world, and for that matter in many transition economies, in other words a large part of the world now, we eat significantly more protein than we need to repair our tissues for growth in children, and even for active adults who are using a lot of energy and a lot of muscle power and so on. We consume a lot more protein than our bodies require. What happens to the surplus protein that we consume? And the answer is it's simply burned for energy, and it's a less efficient process creating your energy from protein, because it has to be deaminated and turned into material that can be then burned in the cells for energy. This is a very inefficient way of supplying human beings with energy. They could have just as well got that energy from carbohydrates.
But there are other sources of protein beside meat. We can get our protein from other sources. Perhaps meat as a source of protein is less efficient, or places us outside that safe operating space vis-a-vis other sources of protein. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, exactly so. That's exactly the point, that because livestock production, animal production, is inefficient and leaky, therefore there are plenty of other sources of protein, plant protein, pulses and so on, that are less leaky, less damaging to the environment. But we should be consuming, our conclusion is that we're over consuming livestock products, especially meat. That's what should be cut down, but we're over consuming proteins generally. Although most of the excess, in a sense, is livestock products, but we're over-consuming calories too. I mean, that's another problem: is that we're simply consuming too much food for our own good, and certainly for the planet's good. And so, there's a difficult story there that we should be consuming less in total and higher quality, and therefore avoid a significant part of the environmental damage that we're now creating. But let me just mention the positive sides of livestock, because it's, to me, a European landscape, and you can speak for yourselves in North America, a European landscape without animals would be unacceptable to most Europeans.
And it's sort of the image of Europe. It's that bucolic image of cows and sheep grazing on fields. It's iconic.
Exactly, and relatively small fields, because they in themselves have created the animals and the field management that's used to support livestock production, or can be used to support livestock production, create the kind of cultural landscape that Europeans want. And the places where Europeans go on their holidays is either to the coast or they go into the countryside, and they don't go to the arable areas or the horticultural areas. They go to the pastoral areas. They're often in the uplands, but they can also be on lowlands, marshlands, and so on. These are the landscapes that people enjoy, and they're associated with livestock production. So there's what we wanted to do was to try and shift the debate to make some to get some traction on some of these issues, because they're being talked about for a very long time and nothing much was happening, by, in a sense, trying to find another concept to get people to focus attention. And that's where we focused on safe operating space. And the notion is that the negatives define the upper limits to that space. The positive contributions of livestock to pasture utilization, and also in providing high quality, enjoyable protein, these should lead us to be able to calculate a lower limits to the safe operating space. And what we find in the quantification, which is very preliminary that we've done so far, is that Europe, of course, is not in its space. It's way in excess of the upper limits, and we don't need anything like the number of livestock to supply the lower limits.
I want to get to some of the solutions that you're proposing in your report, but you've spoken about nutrient leakage, the amount of nutrients, volume of nutrients that need to be applied to landscapes in order to support livestock production, and all the leakage. But how about energy inputs and associated greenhouse gas emissions? Like, we've all heard about the energy intensity of associated with raising a cow versus raising, I don't know, a hectare of wheat, and it's more energy intensive to produce meat. Can you comment on that?
It's interesting you say that, David, because that's not a metric and it's not a dimension that you're the first person in the year and a half since we've been doing this study who's drawn attention to that. That we, in a sense, the energy that I think we're making the same argument, but indirectly, that for us, given the intensity of European agriculture and the fact that Europe is importing a huge amount of nutrient, both in terms of feed for pigs, dairy cows, and chickens, and we're manufacturing a massive amount of fertilizer, which we're adding to the system. It's the nutrient intensity, and then the associated leakage of either ammonia, which is a air pollutant, or greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide. The focus is on that rather than energy consumption by the animals. But of course, if you're making the arguments that animals are utilizing protein and nitrogen and phosphorus inefficiently, well, then I would say the argument will obviously carry forward. You're using energy inefficiently too. It's better for. I mean, that was the point I was making a few moments ago. To the extent that human beings are over-consuming animal products and then simply burning them for energy, it would have been much more efficient for them to have consumed vegetable material, crops, cereals, vegetables, and so on, derive their energy from that directly, because it cuts out the inefficiency of animals. Because we know how many kilograms of feed it takes to get a kilogram of chicken, which is a smaller number than the equivalent number for pigs, which is smaller than the equivalent number for livestock. They are inefficient ways of converting energy and vital nutrients. And it's a combination of the inefficiency and the leakage and the fact that we're over-consuming that makes a devastating mix, which says that humankind, you haven't always eaten the rate we currently have. It's interesting that these overconsumption trends are something that's come on in the last four or five decades. and they come with economic development and the relative cheapening of food and the massive increase in the variety of foods that people can have access to in 24 hours a day, that we simply eat too much, and it's not doing us any good. It's not doing the climate any good.
Let's talk about some of the solutions. How do we move food production, livestock production, back into a safe operating space?
Our view, and I don't know how this argument sounds in your part of the world, but our view is that we've got to persuade our top-level politicians that this is an issue that they have to talk about, because they don't. It's regarded as too difficult, too complicated, and not of sufficient importance given all the other hugely important strategic issues that we've got to deal with. But in our view, that I think we've persuaded the public they have to decarbonize energy. We have to run with the same story, except you've got to consume less livestock products. We're not asking people to become vegans and vegetarians because we want some minimal level of livestock, for all the reasons I've said. That I think that human beings are, there's plenty of room for diversity in eating cultures and so on. But the critical thing is that the bulk of us who are simply consuming more than is good for us and is good for the environment, the more we can hear it being said and repeated at the highest level, that is the case, rather than these periodic reports from NGOs, which I think those people are doing an important service in society by drawing attention to this, but they don't always carry that much weight. And so that's our first thing, is to get this reviewed at a higher level. Because in Europe, we have a very big and quite expensive apparatus for supporting agriculture, and we're simply saying it's not good enough, that it doesn't, it's not honest enough in reflecting that agriculture's got to make a larger transition than the politicians are suggesting. The farmers don't want to hear that. They're struggling to make the changes they're already being told about. But I think we have to face this.
What should replace, or what can replace, livestock production?
Well, we see our first point is, I mean, to be blunt, nothing. Just eat less. Eat less protein and less livestock protein. But of course, people should go for a balanced diet. We're not saying exclude livestock. We're saying reduce it. Let's say 40-50% have many more livestock-free, or particularly meat-free meals per week, and that would do the trick, and have less meat when you have it.
But you speak in your report about novel foods, and I think amongst the most novel foods are crickets. People talk about cricket production these days as an alternative, much more sustainable source of protein.
Yeah, these are all are being looked at. We absolutely encourage they should be looked at. Insect protein, algal protein, nuts, pulses, the plant-based protein, and these novel sources, even cultured meat. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't one solution that can, I think, make a rather small contribution. But I think also we can be finding different protein sources to feed our animals on, and that can certainly include insect protein, and that's beginning to scale up. But those alternative protein sources, I think they're interesting, but I think they've got a long way to go before they can be scaled up to significantly displace the existing sources of protein, of soya in particular. You're talking about requiring tens of millions of tons, and at the moment those sorts of production systems are dealing with handfuls of tons, not even hundreds or thousands. It's got a long way to go, and we don't know what the challenges are of large-scale insect production. You know, what about containment? What diseases will they suffer from? What substrates are they feeding on? And what are the facilities when they get scaled up like to live next door to? And we've got a long way to go to discover the answer to those questions. But of course, it's good that people are looking at them. I think that more of the solution is already in known technologies, you can have a perfectly good diet by having less meat and more nuts, pulses, and other existing proteins. I mean, we're seeing a lot more veggie burgers. You could have a delicious burger that you know, with the skills that we now have in finding flavors and preparing our foods, that's you don't have to have a burger that's based on 100% meat.
Emeritus Professor Alan Buckwell taught agricultural economics at Newcastle University and Wye College in the UK. He was policy director of the Country Land and Business Association and is currently senior research fellow at the Institute for European Environmental Policy. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep dishing up Earth voices and stories to listen to, read, and watch. Mention the word bacteria. Some people recoil in horror. Truth be told, most prokaryotes are perfectly harmless and even helpful. Better yet, bugs are fun to grow, observe, play with, and harness for useful purposes outside and inside your body. Listen to this. These are very complicated structures you've got.
Yeah, they're called reactors, so we call them chemostats or bioreactors. And we grow our bacteria continuously.
In a crowded lab at Radboud University in the Dutch city of Nijmegen, Marjan Smolders grows bacteria that thrive in soil and water, not in people.
And then we'll go to the Winogradsky column, which is in the controlled temperature room.
Down the hall, Smolders shows me how to grow environmental bacteria on your kitchen sill for fun.
So these are Winogradsky columns. These are the ones the students made.
And it's just in a soft drink bottle.
Yeah, in a 500ml bottle.
Sergei Winogradsky, renowned Ukrainian microbiologist. In the early 20th century, he grew bacteria in glass columns, the kind that cycle carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur in soil and water. So this looks like something that people could do at home.
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah.
Winogradsky columns are easy to set up. Pour a cup of pond sediment into a clear plastic or glass bottle. Add a square of toilet paper, a teaspoon of Epsom salt, a bit of egg, some eggshell, and a rusty nail. Top up with more pond water, close the bottle, leave it on a sunny sill, and wait.
Oh, this one's much nicer. See? You see, really clearly see the purpley-orange patches of sulfur bacteria and the green patches of green sulfur bacteria.
I mean, these are things, something that little kids could do.
Yeah. It's not toxic and not dangerous because these are environmental bacteria, so they're not going to harm you.
Winogradsky columns are safe, but you don't want to taste their magic. Sauerkraut is another story. Anna Sigrether studies fermentation culture at Concordia University and creates her own ferments. Sauerkraut is easy, she says.
So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight. And in that salty cabbage juice, that becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli, which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate. There's a bacteria called Leuconostoc. Those bacteria can come in and generate some of the more like tasty flavors before the just lactobacillus just comes in and just rips that pH right down.
For Anna Sigrether, bacterial ferments are more than just tasty.
Honestly, you know, it's quite romantic in the 19th century sense of the term, you know, the idea of the sublime nature, the something that's kind of at once beautiful and awe-inspiring.
Often people say we are what we eat, but I think we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat.
For Janelle Healy, awesome stuff happens down in our gut, and we can join in. Healy is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of British Columbia and a registered dietitian.
A westernized diet is generally considered to not be helping our gut microbes thrive. And so having more plant-based diets, a Mediterranean diet, diets that are variable with a mix of different food groups, seems to be more beneficial to our microbes because it allows us to feed them with the substrates that they need.
Gut microbes enjoy fermentable oligosaccharides, a common component of bananas, onions, leeks, garlic, asparagus, artichokes, and whole grains. They also like fresh fruit, berries, and nuts. But feel free to experiment, says Healy.
We're a little petri dish where we can kind of experiment with ourselves and our diet. Yeah, if you feed them well, they will look after you.
Then there's the experiment on your windowsill.
These, for example, are cyanobacteria.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's spirulina. You can eat this. Spirulina platensis. Really healthy, and they've got lots of very good omega-3 fatty acids.
According to recent research, spirulina also reduces oxidative stress and inflammation in athletes and may be useful in the treatment of diabetes. How it works is not clear. Microbe magic.
Yes, it is. They're really cool. They're beautiful. Yeah, clever bacteria.
For details on how to set up your own Vinogradsky column or Winogradsky column, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. And while you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, hugely grateful. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Gotta say it twice. The so-called eternal undivided capital of what a growing number of credible observers call an apartheid state. Under the 2002 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, apartheid is defined as, quote, an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime, unquote. In search of Israeli apartheid, go no further than East Jerusalem, home to 362,000 indigenous Palestinians and 234,000 Jewish settlers transferred into East Jerusalem across the Green Line beyond Israel's legal borders in flagrant breach of international law. East Jerusalem's Jewish settlers get all the breaks. The Palestinians get surveilled, humiliated, harassed, attacked, arrested, shot, no questions asked. Their homes get confiscated or bulldozed. Israel's aim? To get rid of them, thereby boosting Jewish demographics. I toured East Jerusalem with a chap named Shai Goren. Goren is a teacher and tour guide with the progressive Israeli group Ir Amin.
So on these tours, I'll say we go from Gilo, from the most southern end of Jerusalem, overlooking Bethlehem and Bejala, and we start shifting around the city towards north, and then we end in the areas of the separation wall around the Shoifat refugee camp and Kufar Aqab. So that gives, I think, a good understanding of how was Jerusalem built to begin with, why was the annexation done the way it was, and how that leads to things happening right now.
The government of Israel talks about Jerusalem as being the eternal, undivided capital of the state of Israel. But Jerusalem today, geographically speaking, is much, much bigger. The boundaries of Jerusalem, as they have been established progressively since 1967, are much bigger than what Jerusalem was at the time of David.
Huge difference. I mean, Jerusalem's old city, which many people will say that's, the classic Jerusalem for 4,000 years, it's a very small city of 1 square kilometer. And then, okay, at one point, Jerusalem comes out of the city walls. That's happening around 1860. And there are a couple of very famous Jewish neighborhoods and Palestinian neighborhoods to leave the city walls. And you see kind of a very nice urban flow of development in the town. So Jews build Mishkenot Sha'ananim, and the Palestinians build Baba Zara and Sheikh Jarrah, which becomes very famous in the last couple of years. But the city yet is not very big. It's a couple of square kilometers in it. What happens in the division in 1948, after the war, is that we see two Jerusalems. Now, the western part of Jerusalem is a fairly big city, but still it's not huge. It's about the same as the municipality of Tel Aviv. We're talking about 50 square kilometers, and that would be the city up until 1967. And Israel invests a lot in the western part of Jerusalem in order to make sure that people understand that's going to be the capital, and since what internationally it wasn't supposed to be the capital. It was supposed to be an international city under the UN resolution from 1947. So Israel invests a lot in West Jerusalem, from the parliament to Supreme Court, President's home, you know, making it kind of a cultural center and the capital. And the Jordanians, at the same time, they used the eastern part of Jerusalem as their secondary capital from the 1960s, but it's not a big city. It's about 6 square kilometers. So take the old city, add a bit to the north, to the south, what we call the historic basin of Jerusalem. So it leads down to Silwan and up to Sheikh Jarrah and east to the Mount of Olives, but yet it's a very small city. And that's home of a couple of thousands or tens of thousands of Palestinians up until 67. But what the annexation would do in 1967 in order to ensure a Jewish majority in Jerusalem, or to assure lines that will be able to protect Israel in case it would be needed, then Israel stretches the eastern part of Jerusalem and makes it into a monster. And from 6 square kilometers, which is a Jordanian city, now we're talking about 70. So that's times 12. And that means that many Palestinian neighborhoods that were surrounding Jerusalem and never saw themselves as Jerusalemites are now residents of Israel, are now Jerusalemites. So people living in Kfar Aqab in the north, which are much closer to Ramallah, they're now under the sovereignty of Israel, and they receive an Israeli residency because they're living on the way to the airport. That's, and Israel wants the airport. That's near Shoafat. Yeah. So Israel needs the airport, so it would take them and annex them because, you know, it's on the way, we need them. And on the way to the south, because Israel want to have the ridge of Gilo, where we're going right now, then Israel would annex areas like Tzur Baer and Tuba, which never saw themselves as Jerusalemites. Israel is the one to create that monster of Jerusalem. And now we're talking about a city of over 120 square kilometers. That's a huge city. So unlike any other city that's built because of urban development or natural flow of the city, Jerusalem is built over the political ideas. Once you annex and 25% of your capital is Palestinian, then what Israel is wanting to do for those years is to make sure it promises a Jewish majority in the city. And to do so, it needs to build huge Jewish neighborhoods. There was no demographic need at the time. It wasn't that people didn't have a place to live, so we had to build a new neighborhood. We build a neighborhood, and then we look for people to go live in those neighborhoods.
Now, we've crossed the green line.
We've crossed the green line just a couple of minutes ago, but then we went on the highway, so we're going to cross it again. We're doing a meander.
And the green line is a fiction. It doesn't exist. You could just, there's no sign that says you're now crossing the green line.
There isn't. What happened in Jerusalem, and that is, I think, the most successful thing that happened on the eyes of the Israeli governments, I would assume, is that the green line was eroded in the city. And if back in the day the green line correspond with what is the border between Israel and Jordan, or the ceasefire line, since these are enemy countries for those years, what happens is that once the unification is done, Israel takes off that wall that used to cross the city. The city was like Berlin for many years, with a wall that crosses East and West Jerusalem. But after the war, the wall is taken off, and now you don't know where the green line is anymore. So we are now driving right on Begin Highway. And to both the right and left, we're going to see Bet Safafa, which is an interesting story. It's a Palestinian village, but parts of it already became Israel in 1948, right? So those people became citizens of Israel. Very similar to the story in Jaffa, for example, or Haifa, those who stayed. And the others were living in Jordan. And the wall crossed pretty much in the middle of the village, you can say. What Israel did was to take off. Just one second. Was to take off that wall, and now it's impossible for you, with your eyes, to see which part of Bet Safafa is which. But having said that, we're crossing the green line right now, as we're making the turn towards Gilo, And we're going to see one of the most important Israeli neighborhoods slash settlements that were built post-Green Line, post 1967. And nowadays, people enter East Jerusalem and they ask, are we in the West Bank? Well, technically, yes, of course, you're in the West Bank. That was a part of Jordan up until 67. But I have to say that in reality, in practicality, when you're living in East Jerusalem as an Israeli Jew in those homes in Gilo, you don't feel anything different than if you live in a Western neighborhood in Jerusalem. And on that level, the unification of Jerusalem worked for Israel. I don't think the Palestinians expect Israel to remove settlements like Gilo. This is 40,000 people or so living in it. We have 60,000 in Ramot. So the Green Line just became less of an issue in Jerusalem.
This is Gilo.
This is Gilo all around us. You see, it's a nice neighborhood. It's not super expensive, but it's not very, very cheap anymore. It's a mediocre, I mean, in the size of it, and in the class of it, and in the cost of it. It used to be that people moved to Gilo because it was cheaper. That's not necessarily the case anymore. It's an okay neighborhood, nice even. So somebody moving to Gilo doesn't make a political statement that they're moving post the Green Line. We had people on Ir Amim tours that we told them about how Jerusalem was built, and then they told us, well, we live in Gilo, I live in Gilo for 40 years. I never knew I live on the other side of the Green Line. We can even go up on this here. I have bigger groups to go all the way down, but excuse me.
Oh.
Yeah. So we are in Gilo, and we are also in the outskirts of Jerusalem. Showing the map here, we made it all the way to what is the municipal line of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Now, post-annexation, which means already by the month of June 1967, the war is finished after 6 days, and Israel chooses to do something it doesn't do in any other place in the West Bank, and that is to annex a certain area to Israel. That means that from the moment annexation would be done, the Israeli law applies in all parts of East Jerusalem. And the question is, where is exactly the eastern part of Jerusalem going to be? So if we see the Old City as kind of the center of that map, the idea is to kind of protect the Old City, to make sure that it would exist, yeah, under Israel's land, but also to make sure that the city stretches to the mountain ridges that are all around it. And we have one in the east called Mount of Olives, we have one in the north called the Shoifat Ridge, and we have one in the south, which is the Gilo one. The idea is that Israel will be protected. And if at one case, in one day, perhaps the West Bank will be given or handed to the Jordanians or to the Palestinians, I think nobody knows in June of 1967 who is it going to be. But the idea is that the eastern part of Jerusalem would already pass kind of a change. And after the annexation is done, the idea is to build very big Israeli neighborhoods in order to be there. That gives Israel legitimacy to hold those neighborhoods. Some of them are bigger than many cities in Israel. Ramot, for example, is the biggest one, has 60,000 people. And all of them are, as I said, beyond the Green Line. All of them are settlements. All of them are here without agreement of the international law, against the international law. But Israel sees a difference as well. We annex the area, so it's a part of the country. And most people move there, but not because of any ideological reasons, you know, just because it was a cheap area to go. And it feels very connected. So the Green Line, the way Israel sees it, doesn't exist anymore. And we're fighting for that idea, because we see the Green Line as critical in Jerusalem, in Ir Amim. And the best, I think, example we can have for that was going to be in Givat HaMatos. We're going to go there next and see how Israel tries to connect all the neighborhoods in order to make sure that the division of Jerusalem will not happen. And by the way, it could be that the division is not happening and it can't happen. And yet, we are fighting for very basic rights of the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem because they don't have them. So that would be it. So Gilo is a critical one because that is the one that will be built between Israel and between Bejala and Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. So if Bejala is just in front of us right now, we're talking about a Palestinian city now under the Palestinian Authority. What is stopping...
Nominally.
What is?
Nominally under the Palestinian
Nominally.
Authority. The
Nominally.
Israelis go in there anytime
obviously.
They want.
Obviously. Obviously. But it's very easy for Israel that it doesn't have to take care of what's happening in Bejala. You know, when I used to do reserves in the Israeli army, and before Oslo, I mean, when we talked to the older guys in my platoon, they talked about how when there was a, I don't know, let's say a domestic abuse story, then the Israeli army had to go in to a Palestinian city. Now imagine, you know, it's in the middle of a very crowded neighborhood, and the Israeli army and police are, you know, they need to make their way in to stop a very local story. And that's not something that Israeli soldiers, I would assume, yeah, like doing. Now the Israelis have someone to do it. There's a Palestinian police, they take care of all those things that Israel just doesn't want to do. And yet, obviously, if Israel want to take anyone, anyone from areas A, B, or C in the West Bank, it does it. We've been seeing a lot of that actually happening in the last months in the refugee camp of Jenin. And now Bennett is giving his final interviews and is very proud to say, oh, I've been sending troops every day to those areas. So, of course, Israel is the only real sovereign power here. And the Palestinian Authority is perhaps kind of a contractor that does, you know, collecting some taxes, sending some police, but it has no power in reality.
So why do organizations like Ir Amin oppose the erasure of the Green Line, the vanishing of the Green Line? Because I suspect for most ordinary Israelis, the Green Line doesn't exist. They cross back and forth and back and forth, and you know, not just settlers, but people who travel to the Dead Sea.
Right.
And here in Jerusalem, it's the most obvious. You just go back and forth. There is no Green Line. Why is this an issue for Ir Amin?
Okay, so first, I think if in Jerusalem Israel's project was very successful in trying to erase the Green Line, I don't know if in the rest of the country it was as successful. Because there's a good amount of Israelis who, it doesn't even matter their political view, they don't go to settlements. It's not because they boycott the settlements or they're against the settlements. They don't feel safe in the settlements. They feel there's something else in the spirit there. If you're a Google engineer, yeah, living in Tel Aviv or Herzliya, you have nothing to look for in Ariel. And you're not going to move there because it's cheaper and you're not going to visit it as often. So if you're going to take the route, as you said, from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea every couple of years, okay, that might happen. But on an everyday reality, you're not going to Hebron. You're not going to go to the settlements around Nablus. It just doesn't happen. The main group who goes to settlements are people living in settlements. They don't have many jobs within the settlements. They have to go and travel to Israel to work. So the Green Line is very much felt in those areas. There's checkpoints, there's the wall. You feel when you pass it, and many people don't want to do it. They feel not safe. They feel it's not okay to be there, and they understand the two systems of laws. Jerusalem is a different story, though. And we would ask, I think, in the NGO, is the work of the Green Line, or erasing the Green Line, in Jerusalem, is it supposed to do good for the civilians or for anyone living in Jerusalem or not? Is it for the sake of all Jerusalemites or is it done only to
Jewish and Muslim?
Exactly. Jewish, Israeli, which are citizens, or Muslim and some Christians who are Palestinians and they're residents of Jerusalem. And as we see time after time, the whole idea of erasing the erosion of the Green Line in Jerusalem is only for the sake of Israel and for the Jewish civilians. And for the Jewish population, Israel will never say, okay, we have an annexed city, we have a united city now, united, I say, with some cynicism as well. But we have a united city and we want to take care of everyone who lives here. If we would do so, we would also build Palestinian neighborhoods. But that was never done. From 67 till today, you have here, 11 Israeli neighborhoods, the one that we see on the map, and you have zero new Palestinian neighborhoods. So I think many years the idea was that, you know, we're keeping some of the status quo of Jerusalem and maybe one day the eastern part will become Palestinian. Once again, I don't know if it will happen, but the idea of making a change on the ground will never be in favor of the Palestinian. If Israel building a neighborhood right here, Givat HaMatos, it's not building it for Palestinians that don't have a place to live in Beit Safafa, that can't build legally in Sur Bahre. It builds it on Palestinian land that was expropriated from individuals, and it's building it to ensure Jewish existence and majority in the city. So we never see a use of the Green Line in favor of the Palestinians. It's always, always in favor of the Israelis. What Israel is doing time after time is to make sure that any resource that could be used in Jerusalem is going to the hands of Jewish Israelis and the Palestinians. Perhaps one day they will give up, they will move out of the city, but that also has a price. If a Palestinian moves out of the city walls of Jerusalem, of the borders of Jerusalem, since they are not citizens of Israel, then they lose the residency. Yeah. So on one level, Israel is trying to perhaps disperse the Palestinians who can't build a home near Gilo, although Gilo is being built. But Beit Safafa doesn't have a place to be built, and Walaje obviously never had a master plan. So they'll move to the West Bank, so outside of city lines of Jerusalem. Once Israel knows about it, they lose the residency. So the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem will decrease. But that plan didn't work. Yes, 15,000 to 20,000 lost their residency, which is a horrible story. But the Palestinians in Jerusalem, they understand that leaving the city is going to cost them their residency, which is their freedom to travel, which is social security, to medical care, to seeing your family, to jobs that are here. So they stay. And the people who actually...
And their attachment to Jerusalem is the cultural capital, cultural, spiritual capital.
Definitely. That's number one. I'm talking about more of the logistics one, but you're absolutely right. But the Israelis were actually the one who left, because the way Jerusalem built didn't make any sense. Why build Gilo when you didn't have population that needed to be here? And what Israel did throughout those years is to attract a more poor and more religious Israeli crowd that made others leave the city. So if Israel had some, you know, bohemian life in the 1970s, that started, that group left the city. And for many years, we saw a decrease in the Jewish population of Jerusalem. And the Palestinians stayed because, well, if they go, they lose everything they have.
And they love Jerusalem.
And they love Jerusalem and their connection to the city. So the Palestinians rose from 25% population in Jerusalem on the day of annexation to 40%. Israel sees it as a huge failure. All of the projects and all of the Judification that Jerusalem is trying to, that Israel is trying to do in the city, on some level they failed. And the place where they failed the most was the area around the old city. Because in that area, what we call the historic basin of Jerusalem, you have about 130,000 Palestinians and you have about 7,000 Jews, which is what? Less than 5% of the population
Wadi
in that
Al-Jos,
area.
Sheikh Jarrah,
exactly.
So, Silwan, Ras Al-Amud.
Exactly, Mount of Olives from the east of the old city.
Isawiya,
a bit outside of that area, but let's say the area that was pretty much aligned with Jordanian Jerusalem, that is very much Palestinian. And no matter what Israel did in the neighborhoods of the ring, so Ramot and Neve Yaakov and Pisgat Ze'ev and even Gilo, it never got to have a good hold of the areas around the old city, of the historic basin. That's why in the last couple of years, the battle is over these neighborhoods, and Israel is fighting so hard with any tool it has in order to take that land. Usually it comes in expense of Palestinians. Because here in Gilo, what Israel could do was expropriate private land and then to build a neighborhood on it. That means there were open areas.
Expropriate private Palestinian land.
Yes, definitely. But here in such a crowded area, Israel cannot do it. And if you want to move Israeli Jews to the areas of the historic basin around the old city, it has to come on the expense of Palestinians. And that's how we hear of evictions and expulsions in Sheikh Jarrah and in Silwan. We're now on a Tuesday in late June. Tomorrow, the story of the Sumarin family is going to make it to the Supreme Court for perhaps our final hearing. And I would, you know, been supporting the family, and we hope they will stay in their home. But Israel claims that there is a law, and because of that law, they can't live there. The law is called absentee property. It means that if you own a home in Jerusalem, but you didn't live in that home because you're in the West Bank, then the home doesn't belong to you.
This is Sheikh Jarrah.
This is a similar story to what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah, but in
the Sumarin family.
Sumarin in Silwan.
In Silwan.
Okay. Sumarin, not only in Silwan. Sumarin lives exactly 30 seconds walk from the main entrance of City of David, which is a national park given to a political NGO called El-Ad. Acronym of El Ir David to the City of David. So that's, super central location, and Israel wants the home. So claims that Musa Sumarin, who lived in the home, he was absentee. He wasn't in Jerusalem. And the family managed to prove that he was there all alone. But they managed to prove it when he died. And then Israel told them, he was all along in the house, so he's not absentee. Okay, we understand. But he died now. Who are the people who inherit the home? Are they Jerusalem residents? And if they're not, then the home doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Israel. Israel can expropriate the home. And you know what? Let's say that already happened. But Israel, time after time, will choose to hand out this home to the same NGO that's working very hard, or association working very hard, in order to push Palestinians out and evict them from their homes and to bring Jewish Israelis instead. That's the story of Silwan. My name is Shai Goren. I work as a guide in the public department of Ir Amim, an NGO that sees Jerusalem as the home and capital of both Israelis and Palestinians who live here. We're right now driving through a neighborhood called Silwan, which is one of the biggest neighborhoods. Marhaba, assalamu alaikum. One of the biggest neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. About 50,000 Palestinians live here. But what we're also seeing is a change that is done in the neighborhood by Jewish settler organizations, one of them known as Ateret Kohanim. What Ateret Kohanim is trying to do in a specific neighborhood that we're looking at called Batan El Hawa is to take custody of homes where Jews used to live up until 1948. So we need to understand that up until 48, up until the war, Jerusalem is a mixed city. We have some Jews living in the eastern part, with many Palestinians living in the western part. And in some neighborhoods, we just see a mix. In this one, we had Jewish Yemenites who lived in Batan El Hawa amongst their Palestinian neighbors, who, by the way, saved their lives. In 1929, when there was riots in Jerusalem and other Palestinians came over to attack Jews, the Palestinian residents of Silwan saved the life of the Jews in their village, and the Jews thanked them with a very famous letter that was done. But those homes were okay. Those homes were deserted already before 1938. The British told those Yemenite Jews they can't protect them and they have to leave. And that story remained up until the year 2003. So about 70 years or 60 years, we had Palestinians who took those homes and paid money actually to stay in those homes. In the year 2003 came a right-wing settler organization that the whole purpose of them is to bring Jews living on expense of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. They went to the Ministry of Justice in Israel and they said, well, the Jewish Yemenites used to live here under an endowment. And since there's no one who's responsible of the endowment, then us, Ateret Kohanim, are volunteering to be the custodian of the endowment. And that was it. By one signature of the Ministry of Justice in Israel, 100 homes were given to a Jewish organization that their all purpose is to kick Palestinians out of their homes. In the last 20 years, they've been working very hard in order to do so.
And those homes were, the Palestinians were evicted from those homes?
Yeah, we had 13 Palestinians to be evicted from these homes. And we have other over 80 families. So there's a couple of hundred individuals, many children, hundreds of kids within these homes who are now under the danger and threat of eviction. And once they will be evicted, then these homes will be taken by Jews. And I want to add to that, I don't think if it was the kids of the Yemenite Jews who lived there, the story would be a whole lot better. But the people who are now taking these homes, they have absolute no connection to the original owners before 1948.
And some of them are like Americans.
Some of them are Americans, some of them are settlers that just need a place to live and they want a place for cheap. And when you have donations with hundreds of millions of dollars given by Jews like Irvin Moscovich, who was the main donor for Ateret Kohanim, then you don't even have to ask rent from the locals who come to take the homes. You can either give it for free or to ask for a couple of hundreds of shekels a month. And those people who go in are going not just because of Ateret Kohanim, they go because of the connection of the right-wing NGO, the settler NGOs, and between the state of Israel. The Israeli government is the master plan of all of what's happening here. Because once a settler moves in, they get private security that is paid by Israel. The Ministry of Housing in Israel invests 3,000 shekels, which is roughly $1,000 a month, for the private protection of a single settler in this neighborhood. Without that, they won't live here. Israel is invested, and Israel want to make sure that they live here. Israel is on top of all of that, just holding hands together with settler organizations like Ateret Kohanim, that has managed to move, as I said, about 100 Jews to the neighborhood. In the same time, the settlers managed to buy an apartment or an apartment building from Palestinians. Palestinians built it, and then they sold it to settlers. They found a Palestinian who was willing to do so. The story has seven floors, and it should be demolished. It's built without a permit. If it was owned still by Palestinians, it would be demolished tomorrow. Israel demolishes 250 apartments a year, so some that have multiple families. But Israel doesn't touch the building in which the settlers live, called Bet Yehonatan, named after Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy in the States.
So and Bet Yehonatan is
just in front of us, post some of the buildings that we can see.
And we see the Israeli flag.
And we're seeing an Israeli flag, not on Bet Yonatan, but also there. The Palestinians who see what is happening, they started the graffiti project, which is called I, as in I, my eye. So I witness Silwan. saying, we're seeing what you're doing to us. We're seeing the discriminatory act that you have. Now, I have to say on a personal note, if Israel want to open up the files before 1948, go ahead, open up the files. If you have ownership of land before 1948, allow people to go back to their homes. But not only Jews in East Jerusalem, allow Palestinians to go back to their homes in West Jerusalem, in Jaffa, in Haifa. There were 800,000 Palestinians who became refugees in 1948. They can't go back to their homes because Israel had a different law called the absentee property law that determines that that's it. They lost their homes already in the year 1950. But the second law that was legislated after the annexation of Jerusalem, called Administrative Order from 1970, claims that if you left belongings here in Jordanian Jerusalem, meaning if you're Jewish Israeli, you can retrieve your belongings. There's one law that enables Jews to go back to their homes, and for that would evict the Palestinians. There's another law that stops the Palestinians from getting their original homes.
Now, what are the conditions for Palestinians of Silwan who are living all around these little Jewish settlement outposts within really, really densely crowded Silwan?
Right. So,
what's it like for a Palestinian living right next to one of these little Jewish outposts?
I'll tell you what. First of all, life of Palestinians in Jerusalem is not easy because you're living without a master plan. And municipality doesn't go and not clean the street, doesn't give you connection to sewage many times. We talked about electricity cuts that are here. But the people who live in this part of Silwan called Batan El Hawa, they live even more terrible scenario because there are settlers in their neighborhoods that has private security. That's not even Israeli police that officially, you know, is a body that you can go and file a complaint if they do something wrong. Not that anybody will care about that complaint, but at least officially. Here is a private security system that can also attack those Palestinians. And we heard of multiple cases that Palestinians in the neighborhood are attacked. We work closely in Iramim with one individual from the neighborhood, who's the speaker of Batan El Hawa, called Zohi Rajbi. His family was beaten multiple times by settlers, by the private security itself.
So leaving your home,
just walking down the street. Listen, if a settler want to leave their home, they're escorted by two security guards. Doesn't mean that every time they leave home, there will be an attack. But it means that if a Palestinian in that area is looking at them and the security thinks that that Palestinian is no good, then they might go and attack him or talk to him in a certain way. And the police is, we know on which side they're on. So Zuhir, our friend, he put security cameras around his house just to try to stop those attacks or to have any kind of evidence once they happen. Now listen, I'll also tell you that there are Palestinians who attack Jewish Israelis. That happened. Yeah, I don't think we shouldn't discuss it. But when that happens, the authorities look at it in a completely different way. It's not that we have two sides here who are in a dispute. We have the Israelis who come over and bring their own people because they want them to take the neighborhood on the expense of Palestinians. And if there is violence in the neighborhood, Israel takes one side. That's how it works.
Shai Goren is a Jewish Israeli teacher and tour guide with the group Ir Amin. We'll link to Ir Amin's website and post more details about the situation in occupied East Jerusalem and the Palestinian West Bank at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, Breda, in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. And please support independent Earth journalism. Subscribe to the GPM at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.